We made this.
The bird, he must fly, and the fish, he must swim. The horse, he must trot, and the girl, she must slim. Let's all join together, hoof in hoof, hand in hand. Fin in fin, wing in wing, it's a very good plan. Let's build a love state. Here in Notting Hill Gate.
Guys, and welcome back to You Have Been Watching, a podcast devoted to looking in depth into the fascinating curiosity man that is the British television sitcom, part of the We Made This podcast network. Now, I'm your host Tony Black, and I'm joined by my co-host Robert Turnbull, and that was me attempting to do a sort of laid-back hippie. In fact, I think I sounded more like David Frost, so it didn't really go well.
That was hello, good evening, and welcome.
And welcome. So, teaches me to try an impression. But I'm sure David Frost was around at the time we're going to be talking about, because this time...
he was a radical satirist at the time, so...
Yeah, he was. He was. He would have been fully immersed in the world of 1969, which is where we're travelling back to, in sitcom terms anyway, or the year 1999, when it was made, as we discussed the short-lived BBC sitcom, Hippies. So, yeah, Rob, terrible introduction aside, we're going back
I think you've really got to grips with the real duality of the concept of 1969 being portrayed in 1999. It just really blows my mind, man. It's just so far out.
See, that's much better. You should have done the intro this week. But we're going back to a cult show here, aren't we? It's been a while since we've done a cult series. So it was we thought it was important to throw something in that people might be less familiar with, or maybe have just plain forgotten, actually, this time around. Yeah, so Hippies was created by Arthur Matthews and... excuse me. I'm coughing.
Yeah.
And Graham Linehan, and solely written by Matthews. Hippies is set in the late 1960s and revolves around a group of hip young people living in a flat in Notting Hill. Ray, Simon Pegg, awkward and deluded. Jill, Sally Phillips, his intended paramour and a woman of defiant of convention who often falls into it. Alex, Julian Ryan Tutt, suave and laid back. And Hugo, Darren Boyd, a little vacant and eccentric. They're developing Mouth, a counterculture magazine who confront the radical anti-establishment ideas of the day, or at least attempt to, and find themselves often failing by the rampant changes to society. So, before we start talking about Hippies, quick reminder to everyone, please follow us on social media at YHBWatchingPod on Facebook and Twitter. And if you're enjoying the show, please do drop us a quick 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts and help us shoot up those podcast comedy charts. Although, obviously, we're not comedians, but we talk about comedy, so it's the same kind of thing. Anyway, Hippies, then, Rob. Let's talk a bit about this. When was your first exposure to this show? What are your general feelings about it overall?
Well, I mean, I watched it when it first came out, which was, I think it was just before Christmas. Because I was at university and it was all my sort of favourite people were in it, people that I really liked from other shows. So I was 100%, on it on this one. So, yeah, I watched it at the time, live, so to speak.
Live, yeah. Yes. I didn't, but I remember... When I think it was you who mentioned Hippies first round when we were talking about shows, and I thought, oh, that rings a distant bell there. So because I was about 17 when this came out, so I was into comedy at that point and sitcoms and things. And I do remember it in the back of my mind, but I don't think I ever watched it for whatever reason. So it was always lurking there, but the first time I watched it was in preparation for this podcast. But it's one of those that I feel like. I feel like I would have or should have watched at the time. You know, I don't quite understand why I didn't, because it, in theory, it ticked a fair few of my boxes in terms of the kind of things I liked. So I don't quite know why I missed it. But then, yeah, I probably wasn't on my own in that regard. What about what you thought of it then? I mean, back then and now, are you a fan? Did you enjoy this one?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of am and am not. I think so. At the time, I don't want to say I loved it at the time, but I really enjoyed it because it was all my favourite people. And it was that sort of slightly silly, you know, we've talked a lot about the very tail end of what we think of as the alternative comedy scene and that weird transition period that was sort of took place, particularly in the sort of early mid 90s around Channel 4 and stuff. And it definitely feels in that vibe. It's a little bit post Blackadder, you know, not quite as silly as Bottom, but, you know, maybe in that sort of ab fab kind of world and not quite as surreal as Father Ted and all this kind of stuff. So I kind of liked it. It was, even at the time, it was a show where I felt like I wanted another series. Like, if there'd been another series, it might have got stronger and then it might be one that I really, really like. Whereas at the time, I was kind of like, yeah, that's cool, I'll watch it next series. Never was a next series. But in the intervening 20 odd years, I kind of have looked back on it fondly as being one of those weird little quirks of a show that it wasn't amazing, but I kind of liked it. And I liked it mostly because of who was in it. Watching it again in preparation for this, it's really weird. It's like I kind of came away from it. In some ways, it's better than I remember it. And in other ways, it's worse than I remember it. It was a really weird thing rewatching it. So I'm kind of, I've definitely got a soft spot for it. I guess I was and am a fan. I think so. How did you feel like first watching?
I thought it was quite average, really. It's funny because the comic pedigree in this is quite strong, because you have not, like,
absolutely,
like,
yeah,
you say, you have a lot of performers who are still going strong today, and you have I mean, you know, say what you like about Linehan, he has created some really good comedy, in my opinion anyway. Obviously, he just came up with the idea with Matthews, but Matthews has proven himself time and time again to be a really, really fine comic writer, I think. And, you know, so you've got all of these things. You have loads of really, really interesting guests, characters who pop up, actors in this, comedians. You know, it has the basis of being, it's funny, it has the building blocks of being potentially a genuinely classic late 90s, early noughties sitcom for the BBC. But it just doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite hold together. And I think you hit, yeah, I think what you hit it, and we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, but you hit the nail on the head there when you sort of were saying, oh, well, it's a little bit like Bottom, but not quite. It's got a little bit of that alternative comedy, but not quite. It's not quite a lot of different things that did all of that better, mostly beforehand and subsequently in some cases. And I think I think it could have got better. So I am sad we didn't see more of it, and there are reasons why, but as a first series, it's not a strong first series of a sitcom, and I think it maybe that's one of the reasons it hasn't had the traction, even with all this talent around it, that you might think it will, or it definitely would have done. I think if this had had two or three series, I think it would have been much better and much better received generally, and more people would remember it. So very lukewarm.
I think that's absolutely it. Yeah, I think that's completely fair appraisal, especially as you, like, your first watch of it. It's like I say, I watched it at the time. I have some nice memories of watching it at university.
Yeah.
My sitcom loving friend at university, he used to come over, we'd watch it together because it was all our favorite people. So I've got a little bit of the nostalgia factor,
totally,
to it, having watched it first time round. But undeniable that it's not a classic. It's like, I don't think it's shit, but it's just not there. You know, some sitcoms, you watch the first series and it's fully formed.
Yeah.
It's like, bang, here we go, that's it. Whereas this, it is a little bit like something like, I don't know, Black Books, where I think Black Books is a show that you know, I'm not the world's biggest fan of Black Books, but I think that it's a show that got better later on. And we'll do that show, I'm sure, at some point, and talk about, you know, the different writers getting involved and creative control going in different directions that maybe is why. But I think this is a little bit like looking at the first series of something like Black Books. If we'd only ever had series one of Black Books, I don't think we'd remember it as fondly. But there are several series of it, and it really establishes itself and the characters sort of get a life of their own. And I think that's kind of the case with this. I think even a second series, we might be looking back at this a bit more fondly. But like you say, I think if it hit three, we probably would have done this in series one and be talking about why the third series was actually the best, even though the best episode was in series two. I think it's like we've both said, there's so much potential there, and the potential isn't reached in the first series. But I don't think it's entirely squandered. I think there are, but there's no kind of like standout moment of like, oh, this is an iconic gag. No. There's nothing like that.
It's funny you should mention Black Books, because it's a good segue into what we're going to talk about. But we'll have an interesting discussion on that one, because I slightly disagree with you on that show. But we'll put a pin in that.
No, go for it. Yeah.
We'll come back to it when we talk about it. But I think that first series of Black Books is the funniest. But we'll do that another time. we'll maybe put that up the schedule and talk about it.
Definitely.
Because one of the reasons I think that Linehan wasn't more involved in Hippies is because he was in the process of making Black Books at the time, and that was something, because that was around the same kind. I think it might have been 2000 the first series of Black Books came out. So I think that was one of the reasons that Matthews takes this on solo, because obviously this is the first big project that they create after Father Ted. You know, Father Ted finishes a year before, at the same time that Dermot Morgan dies, very unexpectedly, at the end of Father Ted. And so they have established, and that was obviously Channel 4, and they've previously done Paris, Alexis Hale's Paris, which we talked about last year, which is, again, a one-season sitcom, which is very cult. And I do think Hippies is better than that, for the record, to be fair.
It is better, but I'll circle back around to that in a second.
Yeah, cool. So whereas with Paris, we were talking about how they will do Father Ted and have that success. Now we're talking about after Father Ted, and they've had that big success. So there's maybe quite a lot of expectation on Arthur Matthews here, and a lot of anticipation for Hippies, which made, because it isn't the same as Father Ted. In fact, I think it's got very different kind of inspirational sort of comic source material. So maybe there was a lot of expectation on him and it being the BBC as well, that could have got in the way here a little bit.
I think that could be a factor. I also think it could be that people just didn't notice it, because I feel like maybe at that time people were slightly less they were slightly less attached to their actors and their artists and stuff. It's like we've talked about the cast in it, brilliant cast, it had all, you know, done plenty, were doing plenty then, but none of them had quite hit the peak. I think this was just before they all really, you know, it's a little bit before it's around the same sort of time as Spaced, I guess, but it was, you know, it was a bit before Green Wing and all this kind of thing. So I think a lot of the cast in it hadn't exploded yet. And I don't know how much the general audience cared about who wrote something at that
maybe.
Point. I don't know whether people would be going, "Oh, Arthur Matthews."
No, probably not. No.
I don't know. I mean, I could be talking out of turn, but so I don't know. I'm just not sure whether people noticed it.
I think that might be the case. I mean, it was apparently heavily marketed, and I think, you know, it had a lot of promotion beforehand. But, you know, they were trying to big this up as, I mean, this is one of the last sitcoms to go out of the 20th century on the BBC. The last episode of this goes out on the 17th of December 1999. So this is very, very much at the end of a year, and around a point where there's an incredible amount of millennial anticipation of what's going to happen in 2 weeks' time. And so maybe it kind of got a bit lost in the bigger you know, excitement about the millennium, Millennium Eve. You know, who knows? There could be lots of factors around that point.
Yeah, I mean, Christmas and millennium, Christmas is always a big time anyway. People's TV habits change.
Yep.
You know, come mid-November, you know, right through December, people's television habits do kind of change. Maybe it just wasn't... This needed to go out in July.
Yeah, it's a summer show, you know, for sure.
Proverbial summer of 69. Yeah. Exactly. And maybe that's it. Maybe it just got lost. It could be a mixture of factors. You know, the expectation on Matthews as a writer, how well it was marketed, the time of year that it came out. It could be all these things, or it could just be that most people thought it was a bit shit.
Well, I think that's part of it. And the sad thing about that is that Matthews is halfway into writing a second season of this. At the point it goes out and it gets lukewarm at best reception, and he stops. They've said to him, you can have a second series, which, you know, is fairly common, I think, really. You know, a lot of shows would probably get at least another go, you know, especially with this kind of talent.
Yeah, it was back.
Yeah, back then.
Back and, in the day, the BBC were almost always two series, yeah.
Yeah. But he stops. He gives up. He decides not to do it. And I think that's a real shame in that, you know, I mean, God knows how... I mean, that was before the days of social media. I mean, my God, but he still saw bad reviews at various places, and he stopped doing it, which I think is a real shame. And, you know, there were ideas, there were scripts written, there were what sound like some quite funny ideas, really, and he would have brought back certain characters and stuff like that. So I think it is a bit of a shame. And maybe we'll come back and we'll talk a bit more about those ideas that he would have done at the end, actually. But it's... Yeah, it's a shame because this really, in terms of those inspirations, this does have its DNA in a bunch of different stuff in terms of BBC comedy. You know, it has like you mentioned, it's got a little bit of that Ab Fab 60s aspect in there, which is... Ab Fab is a show we're going to do in detail in a couple of months, actually. We've already recorded the episode on that, and that's coming out for the 30th anniversary, and that's all about how it leans back to the 60s and things like that. So... you know, look out for that, listeners. But it's got a bit of that in there. It's definitely got a little bit of the anarchism of Bottom, particularly in Simon Pegg's character as well. And it was an interesting piece, like a revisionist piece.
It falls down two or three times per episode.
Yeah, or he gets smacked in the face by somebody. But there was also an interesting revisionist piece that I read where there was a comparison made to Dad's Army, which I thought was very interesting, actually, because when I thought about that, you know, they made the comparisons of, you know, Peg's character being like Captain Mannerin. And particularly I thought, yeah, when they said, well, the character of Alex, who's the smooth, you know, laid back guy, when they said, Sergeant Wilson, you know, John LeMessurier. And it's like, yeah, I can really see that in a way, you know, and see, and then being in this contained environment where they are perennially, you know, unsuccessful, really. It just fitted. So there's, in a way, even though it might have moments of the surrealism of something like Father Ted, and it does, it definitely seems to have one foot in various different eras, particularly whether it's the alternative sort of smash you in the face, you know, comedy of, you know, a heightened reality comedy of Bottom or whatever. Or, you know, so the point also was made that Hugo, the character of Hugo, is a little bit like Neil from The Young Ones. So it goes down that well as well. And then you've also got much further back into the, you know, the 60s and 70s with those kind of characters. And I thought that was interesting, that Hippies maybe borrows from both non-conventional and conventional sitcom at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's a good assessment, to be honest. I think it's maybe trying to mash different things together. It's also possible that, you know, Wilson had an affair with a young Eleanor Bron. Who knows? That explains Julia Rinehart's character. I think it's, you know what? So we referenced Paris, actually, briefly, that we did another episode on. Which, and of course, this and Paris are the kind of the bread in the Father Ted sandwich of what these guys were producing. Weirdly, I think this show is incredibly like Paris. I think it's better than Paris. I think it's definitely better than Paris. I think the writing, the comedy, the acting is better than Paris. But I think actually the structure of it, it's very, very similar. When you think about Paris was this kind of slightly hyper-real, deliberately anachronistic interpretation of the kind of 20s art scene. And this is the same, but for the sort of the 60s free radical movement, you know, it's like, I think this is really like Paris. And I, to be honest, I'd say to the detriment, not so much because, I mean, it's like, nobody remembers Paris, hardly anyone remembers hippies. But for me, someone who watched them both at the time, especially because we've watched them back to talk about them, there is a part of me that's looking and going, right, so they had this one idea and they just kind of came back to it after a while. Especially the last episode of this. It's basically the same as the last episode of Paris.
Yeah, that's true, actually. It is, isn't it? There is a similarity. I wonder why, what that is, that they're trying to explore that in, you know, various different ways, because they are, on the face of it, they might seem like very different sitcoms. But yeah, that's true, actually. I think there is a similarity, really. And it's a funny one, isn't it? Because like you say, nobody really remembers Paris. You know, that's there might be there will be people, yeah, out there who remember hippies.
Even Alexis Sale doesn't remember
probably,
Paris.
Yeah. There will be people out there who remember hippies, but yeah, they are few and far between. But yeah, that's an interesting comparison, definitely. Arthur Matthews was asked about potential sort of inspirations, but if you look past the comedy, there was one that was pointed out in an interview, which was a documentary, a TV drama based on documentary events, which was called The Trials of Oz, which was from 1991. And it was an anthology of plays, and it was all about the prosecution of the Oz magazine in the middle of 1971, which was, and this links to the final episode of Hippies, where Ray is prosecuted for obscenity when on the further front, this is a funny joke, front page print, "I am a cunt," which is really funny.
Yeah.
And, without showing the full word, obviously, because this is the BBC in the 90s. It was quite a well-known court case, and it's a reenactment of various different aspects of the court case, with Hugh Grant playing the main guy who was writing Oz, called Richard Neville. And I think he wrote a book as well that Matthews read. And one of the things he was basically saying, that he was very interested in the ridiculousness of all of these people, basically, and the fact they were smelling their own farts, essentially, really, at the time. And he just thought that was very interesting to explore, based on, you know, a trial for these kind of publications who were pushing the, you know, what they could do. I think he described it as incredible naive idealism and blind enthusiasm mixed with sexism and drug taking, and that's essentially what he tries to capture, isn't it, in Hippies, really? These clueless people trying to make their mark in this counterculture world and being really, really rubbish at it.
That's it. And I think it's an interesting thing, because, you know, we do look back at the 60s with this very cynical mind now. There's no getting away from it that some of the things that were done in the 60s, some of the movements that existed in the 60s were incredibly important and have helped shift and change the world. But there was also a lot of shit going on. There was a lot of just pompous, like you say, smelling your own fart stuff. And in the middle of this weird decade, there was all this pomposity. And even the best people, the people actually making a change, the people who really truly believed in what they were doing, were still quite often pompous, pretentious, middle class, you know, Oxbridge types, just kind of like sticking it to mummy and daddy. And so to do a show which is basically the losers, the wannabes, which is what it is, you know, Ray is absolutely a wannabe. You know, he doesn't quite have the guts to blow things up. You know, he goes to the sandpaper convention and protests sandpaper because he doesn't quite have the oomph, you know. And like Jill is sort of she's a feminist, but it's almost like she can't be bothered to do any feminist stuff. Although I do want to I know we'll talk about the characters in greater detail in a second. So it's an interesting idea, the sort of the joke of it. It's a little bit like in Life of Brian, you know, you follow Brian around and he's
very naughty boy.
You know, he's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. But in the background, we see Jesus every so often in the background doing proper Jesus stuff. And I think this is similar in that you imagine that there's some really important stuff going on. You know, the episode with the sex party.
Yeah.
Again, super pretentious. You know, the professor is that they all sort of see is super pretentious and up their own arse. But you get the idea that there are people out there doing proper radical protests. And these guys are just at the bottom kind of going, yeah, let's go to the park and protest ducks. It's like, it's just the silly, facile, you know, the wannabes. You know, their magazine wasn't going to change the world. But, you know, but they put everything into it. But then, you know, one day the police are nice to them. So they change their stance on fuck the police.
Yeah.
It's this is what we keep saying, though. There's so much good. There's so much potential here that I don't think, you know, doesn't live up to.
No, doesn't quite come off, does it? But but I think what was interesting was that Matthews clearly had an interest in these kind of ridiculous people who, you know, he thought were awful people at the time, you know, and who were trying to tap into something that was already by 1969 on its way out, really, you know, as the 70s was going to kick in and things like this.
Yeah.
So they were at the tail end, and like you said, in a very middle-class way of trying to capitalize on this. But let's talk a little bit about these characters then, because to be fair, as much as the show doesn't quite work, there's four quite good key characters here, played by four really good actors, and they sort of sum up all different aspects of the show. So I mean, firstly, you've got Simon Pegg as Ray. He's the main character it arcs around, really, and Pegg has come off the back of Spaced at this point, hasn't he? So he's done a few other things, but this is before obviously he starts popping up in movies and then just becomes a pretty big Hollywood star that he is kind of now. Although he's a strange one, Simon Pegg, because I can't quite buy him as this sort of quasi action man that he's trying to rebuild himself as in like Mission Impossible and stuff. I can't not see things like this or Spaced. He feels like Simon Pegg feels like he feels like a sitcom star from a bygone age who has somehow made it into like, you know, the biggest action movie in the world next to Tom Cruise. And it's really odd because it feels like he shouldn't be there. It feels like he should be making, you know, these kind of weird little comedies for BBC into Channel 4 into his 40s or 50s. It's odd.
It is a bit of a weird one, isn't it? It's like, I think, you know, I love Simon Pegg to bits. I think I would argue that he's not as good an actor as some of his roles would require in terms of going Hollywood. I think it's great that he's gone Hollywood. It's like all good for him and everything. But I know what you mean. I think the biggest example of this is like he turns up in the Star Trek movies as Scotty. And fine, because he basically became buddies with J.J. Abrams. So he turns up and in those first two movies, Simon Pegg's there playing Scotty and you buy it completely because he's sort of a little bit of a comedy relief character.
Yeah.
Like, oh, can he hold the engines, Captain? Then in the third movie, Simon Pegg writes the film. Suddenly, Scotty's jumping out of spacecraft. He's climbing mountains. He's saving the day. It's like, calm down, Simon, calm down.
Yeah.
You're still that guy who fell over in his flat in Hippies every episode.
Yeah, exactly. And because he's on record as saying one of his comedy heroes is Rick Mayall. And there's definitely an attempt here to recreate both that comedy of falling over, getting smacked in the face by a, you know, a fire extinguisher or whatever, and having all that, and also the sexual repression of Richard in Bottom. You know, he is a little bit of a follow on from that. You know, because Ray just wants to get his end away, basically, with Jill, and every episode he's thwarted by it. So it's a very old-fashioned sitcom idea, really, that Matthews is playing for fun here, and linked to he doesn't obviously have the same anarchism as Rick Mayall or the same delivery, and I would argue he's not nearly as good a comic performer, to be honest. But it's not exactly the same kind of thing, but it's definitely taken a cue from that. And Ray has that balance of, you know, those aspects plus the fact he's working class. He's the most working class character here. and he's, you know, his parents, and he coughed, and some of the funniest scenes are with his parents, aren't they? Which it, and they're two very, very working class, you know, they're early 60s, 50s kind of parents. You know, the dad's in his string vest and he's a proper like bloke.
Yeah.
He's a he can't be doing any of this hippie stuff. You know, and his mum's like, oh, love, you know, do you do what you want to do and all that. And then she's quietly, they are, those two I would have done way more with if I was Matthews in the next series, because I think some of the best stuff is Ray going back home and he's going, no, but what we're doing is really important. You know, we're making a mark on the world, and, you know, and they're going, oh, it's not. It's just plain about love, isn't it? That kind of, you know, that's a really good thing.
I think, yeah, where you would take them forward, because they do kind of, they represent the ambivalent general populace that Ray is fighting for and against, who it makes no impact on. It's like there's so much potential there. But I think you're right. There's that a little bit of that sort of like Rick Mail going on. But I also like watching it again. I was feeling it's a very there was something very Coogan about it. There was something a little bit Alan Partridge, especially when he's sort of trying to be cool. Because I think especially, I mean, obviously he's not. You know, he's not copying Rick Mail. He's not copying Coogan per se. But I think you're right. There are elements of the Richie character. But of course, he doesn't have that kind of like side of it. But I think whereas as someone like Richie, you know, when he does his, he tries to be smooth and cool, he kind of goes, oh, hello, oh, lady. And he sort of does that slightly creepy. I think with Peg's performance here, when he tries to be sort of cool and smooth, there's something very Alan Partridge about
it. Yeah, that's which true.
But also, you know, he worked with Coogan a lot. Coogan was one of his sort of mentors. So I think you're right. It's almost like Rick Mail being played by Steve Coogan. Simon Pegg doesn't get a look in. It's just those two.
Well, I know. Yeah, I mean that's a hell of a combination, because they are possibly my two favourite modern comedians, actually, Steve Coogan and Rick Mail. So the fact he's kind of played, but no, you're right. I think you are. That's a really good comparison there. I think, you know, and it's funny you should mention Coogan, because if you look at Sally Phillips as Jill, she's around this time, she's in a bit of what might well be a bit of a career peak, because she's just come off the first series of I'm Alan Partridge, where she's very funny in that as the receptionist who constantly finds Alan hilarious but in for the wrong reason, like she's laughing at him
or, in the worst way possible,
yeah, like at the Linton Travel Tavern, or she plays Sophie the receptionist and she's just cracking up at how weird he is. So she's very good in that, and she plays in a way almost like a bit of a sort of almost like a latent counterculture kind of character in that, isn't she? She's a bit of a 90s, you know, child, in that she's just not very bothered about much. She's very laid back. You know, she's just constantly sloping off with the bellboy guy who she's having a bit of a fling with. You know, she's so that there's that little element there, but there's also she's part of the Smack the Pony troupe around this time, isn't she? And Smack the Pony is very popular at this point, which was a very female a trio of women who did sketch comedy, and it was very successful, Smack the Pony. And I think if I went back and watched that now, I'd find it way funnier than I did when I was 16, 17 years old, where I found it hit and miss. I think that would be razor sharp, I suspect. I would imagine that's aged really well. She's already kind of proven her comic chops at this point, hasn't she?
I think this is the case for, you know, for all four of the main cast. You know, we're going to get onto the other guys in a second, but I think they were all just on the cusp. They were just making it big, which again, maybe, you know, it's like we talk about Simon Pegg and Spaced. It's like, you know, it was Space. This series, he almost made this in between Spaced. It was almost kind of like this, I guess, was his last, you know, let's say conventional sitcom before Spaced. And Spaced was what made him Simon Pegg, as opposed to, oh, that guy who's in that other sitcom, he's really funny. And I think that they were all just on the cusp of making it big. And it's interesting, if this show had been made a year later, their star power might have been bigger. But also, if they'd made another three series of it, they might not have done some of the other projects that actually made them bigger. So I think Sally Phillips, like you say, she was she was sort of right there. It's like probably, in a weird way, she might have been the most recognisable, or at least the person with the biggest success. I'd have to sort of like double check exactly who was in what at exactly what time. But I feel like in terms of Smack the Pony, like you say, that was really big. That was a really big, very popular show. So she might have been sort of the biggest star when this came out, maybe-ish.
Maybe. What's interesting about that is that you talk about Smack the Pony and Space. They're all within about a six-month period of each other. So Smack the Pony's first series is March, April 99. Spaced kicks off late September, October 99. And then the second series of Smack the Pony, by which point it would have been a lot more popular as well, is about April 2000. So this is all happening within a year period, essentially, in which all of these quite iconic sort of comedy projects are happening at the very end of the 90s and into the noughties. So Hippies falls right in the middle of this space, really, which is really interesting because it's more conventional than either of those shows, you know, which have been, you know, I mean, Spaced is very much fondly remembered 20 years on. You know, it's considered a classic of that era, I would say, realistically. And Smack the Pony, maybe a little bit less remembered, but still very well thought of, I think. And, you know, whereas... So Hippies is a funny one because it does. It's got these emerging quite big new comedy stars, but it's right in the middle of these much better, much more successful projects.
Well, I think a big thing as well that we're looking at when you talk about those shows is that in Hippies, these guys are actors for hire. That's the big thing. And it's the difference, you know, Pegg especially, you see it, you know, the difference between Simon Pegg in, you know, in this or Faith in the Future, you know, where he's just actor for hire. He's great fun. But then in Space, where he's produced it and it's kind of his show, it's like his performance and his... maybe his enthusiasm kind of like steps up a notch. I think it's the same with Sally Phillips because, you know, she was more creatively involved in Smack the Pony than she was in this. Plus sketch, you know, sketch comedy gives you more opportunity to sort of like play around and stuff. So it could be that, you know, these guys really blossomed when they were creating their own material to a degree.
Yeah. I think probably. Obviously Phillips plays Jill, and Jill's a fun character because she's the only woman in this ensemble, and she's very much the contradictory feminist, isn't she? Because she comes out with all these feminist statements, and there's one episode which is quite funny where she tells Hugo, do not look at my ass, do not be thinking about my ass, and then he spends the whole episode thinking about her ass, becoming obsessed, And then at the end, she goes, no, it's fine then, but just don't think about my tits. That's how it ends, in that he starts thinking about it. That's a funny joke. But she will quite often, she's obviously refusing to sleep with Rave, even though he's desperate to get his end away with her. But she might be seen now. I'd be interested to see what a woman would make of the character of Jill Roy now. Would they think she's a little bit... of a male-written regressive character, or is it just that she's an example of that champagne feminism maybe at the time, in that actually she wants to be looked on with desire by men, but at the same time she wants to be part of the burn your bras kind of crowd. So, you know, do you know what I mean? There's that it feels like in Jill there is that contradictory.
I was thinking that, like, watching this back. You know, it's a while since I have watched it in the last 20 years, but it's a while since I've watched it. And I was actually less, I didn't like the character of Jill as much, or I didn't like the way she was written as much watching it again. I was aware of a lot more things that I didn't care for. Yeah. And I suspect, especially fresh, especially with no kind of, you know, nostalgia factor, I'm not sure that women would enjoy this character. Because I do think Sally Phillips is fantastic. The character has some good jokes. But I don't think she's written well enough to really pull off what maybe they're trying to do. I think definitely there's the sort of... You can tell that she's been written by a man. And you know what? It is 20-odd years ago. It's like, you know... A male writer's comprehension of how to write a woman now is I'm sure far superior than it was then. Even Matthews could probably write better women now. personally, I don't think that Linehan or Matthews have ever been good at writing women. They can write women who they can write funny characters who are women, but I don't think they've ever been very good at writing women. And I suspect at the time they usually get away with it because it's this hyper reality. But I think, I mean, we're not talking about their other shows, but I think Father Ted is quite unpleasant towards women, quite hateful towards women. I think Paris, you know, we touched on it. The women in there, I don't think are good characters at all. And I think here, Jill, it's an awkward thing because ultimately she does come back to being quite a tropey sitcom girlfriend who won't have sex with me.
Yeah.
And even though that's kind of, a lot of it's kind of like framed through the sort of the irony that she's a 60s radicalist, free love, but she won't have any free love with her boyfriend. I don't think that comes off enough. You see, that's probably the problem with the whole show. I think there are concepts in here that just don't come off very well. And maybe a second series would have worked better. But I think the problem with Jill is this idea of her being a champagne feminist who, you know, who wants to be seen as sexy, but also wants to be a cool feminist. That doesn't really come across because her performance is quite surreal. It's very low, which I think I like it. I like Sally Phillips' performance. But the problem is you don't get this idea that she secretly wants them to look at her ass. You just get this idea that she's weird. And she says, you know, don't look at my ass. Whatever you do, don't look at my ass. And then they look at her ass and she's like, oh, you're looking at my ass. There's no sense that she secretly wants to be desired. So I don't think, I think it's just a really badly written female character. And I think the ideas are there, but like there's one series where she comes in and she goes on about being a sort of a strong, independent woman. And then she goes, ah, a mouse, and like jumps up and screams. And I get that joke. And I think that joke represents what they're trying to do with her character. But I just think she's not written well enough for it to come off. I don't think women would like this character now.
Yeah, no, I get that.
And I wouldn't blame them.
I think you're right, really. I think that it's funny because I think realistically probably the best written character in many ways is Ray, because he is a very clear comic creation, whereas the others, it's a slightly different thing. I mean, if we look at Alex, played by Julian Ryan Tutt, he's the smoothie, you know, he's a very, very middle class layabout, really. He doesn't do anything. He just lies there, you know, smoking and, you know, just reading articles. He doesn't do any work. Well, then we find out that he's from a very privileged kind of, you know, background. But he's not unpleasant. You know, he's not cocky. You know, he's it is. I mean, if they've all
he's
got
the
their...
only one you'd want to be stuck in a lift with. He's
yeah, but he's the they all play variations on the kind of characters they would play in other things. And Julian Ryan Tutt, obviously, is probably. I mean, he's been in loads of things, but he's probably best known for Green Wing, really, where he plays Mac, one of the doctors, and he is playing the same kind of character in many ways, you know. But in Green Wing, he's almost like the hero of that show because he's laid back and he's charming, and everyone around him is either literally crazy or loathsome. so it's slightly different. But I've always liked him as an actor, to be fair. But in this, he doesn't necessarily get a lot to do, I don't think, really. He's kind of, he feels like a character that they might have done more with in a future series, because it feels like he's there and he's around and he's basically just constantly sort of quietly showing up Ray for his stupidity, not in a horrible way necessarily, but I don't know. He feels like he's just sort of there. And maybe that's the point. Maybe that's the point of the character, that he's just there.
I think a lot of it is the fact that he is this sort of passive passenger to Ray's life. You know, he just, you know, he likes Ray. He, you know, he just hangs out, you know, hanging out with Ray doesn't demand too much from him. But I think also as a character within the context of the show as it's written, he's basically a punchline character. That's what he does. He sort of turns up and he provides punchlines to scenes or through threads, this kind of, like in the, there's the episode where, which is it Dirty Hippies, where they go to the festival, and Ray bumps into this big, huge music star, in the toilets, and basically is trying to do an ad hoc interview with him. And there's this big, whole long extended sequence where he's like, he's asking him all these questions and he can't stop pissing because he's taking some weird drugs and, you know, it's all very hilarious. But the whole big gag is that he's squandering this opportunity to have an interview with this huge star because he can't stop pissing, because he took drugs, because he was horny. But then later on, we see Julian Ryan-Tutt has bumped into this artist and has done an amazing interview with him on the fly, even kind of like dismissing some of the crappy questions that Ray had asked without knowing that Ray had asked them. And I think that's what he does a lot. It's like Ray will do some huge, big, elaborate, stupid thing. And then later on in the episode, you see Julian Ryan-Tutt, you see Alex pop up and literally just do something which creates a little punchline to what Ray has been doing. And then more so in some of the actual straight up dialogue scenes. I think he is a passive punchline deliverer.
Yeah, he does. That's kind of his stock in trade, really. You know, that passiveness that, you know, he can let he's very good at that. He's very funny at that. He's got very good comic timing. And he can sort of make that happen. Which, you know, he's something you see in a lot of his characters. But he is good in that context. The last one of the four is the character of Hugo, played by Darren Boyd, who's one of those actors. He's less well known than the other three. And particularly Simon Pegg and Sally Phillips, I would say. But he's spent like 20, 25 years carving out a really good career and a really strong career full of stuff. And he's popped up in so many different things.
Oh, yeah.
And he's always been a really good actor. I remember seeing him just around this time in a show called Kiss Me, Kate. Do you remember that? With Caroline Quentin.
Yes.
Caroline Quentin, Amanda Holden, Chris Langham, who obviously soon after very, very, you know, was erased from the comedy landscape for reasons we'll go into elsewhere. Bill Nighy was in it, but I remember it wasn't a brilliant show, but I quite enjoyed it actually because it had a lot of good actors in it. And he stood out because he played like a sort of a lovable sort of lunk in that, really. And then, but ever since then, he's just gone on to do lots of different things. I mean, most recently, he's been in Apple TV's Trying, which is a lovely show. We should do that one day because that is a lovely sitcom about about parents adopting children. And he plays a very, very pretentious character in that, but he's very good in it. But he's just one of them who's just been consistently there. But he's never had his own starring role, and he's never been, you know, he's not a name I think anyone outside of comedy would really know. But he's very good, and in this, He plays the dopey sort of, like I said earlier, that sort of Neil from The Young Ones kind of character, who is a bit gormless and a bit odd, and yeah, I suppose he's good for a gag, but I don't know if there's a particularly as much of a character there as with some of the others with him.
No, I think you're right. There's not really, none of them really have massive character. You know, Ray is the most rounded character, obviously. And then I think Jill and Alex both have kind of, you know, they're very much characters to support Ray's gags. And then, yeah, I think that Hugo doesn't really have anything other than just to deliver some jokes. He's the Dumbo. He's the, maybe they would have, you know, built on it more. I don't think they would have done. I think the other two characters might have been built on in terms of some character work, but I think Hugo, like, was always going to be somebody weird who steps in, a bit of a Zoidberg, you know, he steps in and he makes a joke and he sort of, like, you know, maybe props up the B plot a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think they get away with a lot in this, you know, because of the strength of the cast. Like you're saying about Darren Boyd, he's a really good actor. I've always enjoyed watching him in things. And like you say, he just turns up in other people's stuff and, you know, always nails the assignment and then disappears. And then he turns up in someone else's project and nails the assignment, and I think that that's a big part of this show. It's like why it works at all, why I have fondness for it, is that core four cast. They elevate what is very average material and they kind of like lift it up higher than it deserved.
Yeah,
really.
No, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that. So yeah, let's take a quick break for an advert and for We Made This Show, and we'll come back in a minute, having talked about the characters, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the ideas in Hippies, a little bit of the reception, maybe an episode we'd recommend for people, and we'll talk a bit more about it. So stay tuned, folks.
...100 years since Nosferatu first terrified audiences on the big screen...
...30 years since Francis Ford Coppola gave us Bram Stoker's Dracula...
...and 10 years since Dark Shadows with Johnny Depp.
Vampire Videos is a podcast taking a look at this iconic blood-sucking monster on film and television.
I'm Dan Owen.
And I'm Hugh McStay.
And we're here to guide you through a century of vampirism on film. From Hollywood's golden age with Bela Lugosi as Count Dracula...
...to the more lurid Hammer horrors of the 60s and 70s starring Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Through to the 80s boom in vampires which brought these creatures of the night into the modern age.
And everything this century's had to offer us. From foreign and independent films, spoof comedies and even teenage love stories... Yes, I'm talking about Twilight.
We aim to cover it all, one bite at a time.
So join us on a voyage into the depths of vampire cinema, old and new, with weekly guests offering their own insights and expertise. And why not follow us on Twitter, @VampVideos.
A proud part of the We Made This podcast network, subscribe now to Vampire Videos, and thanks for listening.
Welcome back, guys. We're talking about Hippies on You Have Been Watching, the 1999 sitcom. And we've gone through some of the characters, some of the actors involved. But obviously, this show is made in the late 90s, set in the 60s, and it gets into a lot of the... what I think at this point, they would be sort of established cliches, wouldn't they, and things like that, and a lot of what people would consider the 60s to be, you know, things like protests, festivals.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's an episode where Jill suddenly has a beard, you know, because women were growing hair. You know, hormones, radical publications, you know, clashing with the establishment, you know, as we said earlier, Ray's put on trial for obscenity, so he has to go in front of a judge and all these kind of things. So it's tapping into a reservoir of very sort of 60s ideas. You know, I mentioned Ab Fab earlier and that we're going to do an episode on that, but that looks at the 60s in a different context, in a different way, in much more of sort of the hedonistic, you know, youthful sort of culture aspect, whereas this is a bit more about Hippies. He's trying to explore that social and cultural aspect of the 60s and radicalism and protest, the protest movement and this kind of thing through that comedy lens, isn't it? I mean, is it successful at that, you know, from the 90s perspective?
I don't think it's entirely successful, but part of the reason I don't think it's entirely successful is, like, I think it's been done. And I think there's maybe a slight arrogance about a writer in the 90s thinking that they can poke fun at the 60s, because ironically, in the 60s, the 60s was poking fun at itself already. You know, we briefly mentioned Frost, you know, it's like, but there's sort of the 60s satirical boom, really, you know, of That Was the Week That Was and Private Eye and this kind of stuff. I think that the satirizing of that time period had already started. And especially, you know, you look at, it's a weird thing. If you look at sitcoms from the 60s, you know, these kind of conventional sitcoms about, you know, middle-class families and stuff, there was always a hippie son or a hippie boyfriend. And I think that even then in the 60s, the kind of the establishment was already making fun of protests and hippies. And, you know, look at Carry On Camping. They, you know, the hippies that turn up in Carry On Camping and get ridiculed by the main cast, they're the same kind of hippies in this sitcom. So although I think they do some quite fun things, it's like the joke with the beard. It's like it's a tricky one, because it is quite funny to see Sally Phillips with this gorgeous beard and kind of, you know, enjoying having a beard. But then there's the slight argument of, like, well, is it weirdly misogynistic to, you know, it's like, oh, women are going to grow hair in their armpits, they might as well grow a beard. It's like, there's that slightly, that's a slightly awkward joke. It's like, is it funny or is it misogynistic? Because I think there were times, especially on this rewatch, that I was watching it, and I felt like the ridicule felt a little bit middle-aged. And I think that a show about the 60s, even making fun of the 60s, needed a vibrancy. Now, the cast are all young and fairly vibrant. You know, I think they're all still in their 20s at this point. You know, maybe sort of, you know, 30 for some of them. But the cast are young and vibrant. But the writing is weirdly old fashioned. And I think it's sort of, it's a lot of it is making fun of young people trying to change the world. And it's really difficult to decide where that's, whether it's just comedy or whether it's a bit snide. Like the whole thing with the police. So it's a great gag. You know, there's an episode where they produce a magazine and the front has a picture of a pig with a policeman's helmet on. And it says, I am a policeman. So that there's no ambiguity. And then it gets stolen. And then two policemen come round to help them find their stolen magazine. And the policemen are the nicest men you could imagine. They're very open-minded and liberal. They're into the concepts that Ray and his team are trying to promote. And then Ray feels really bad about it. And then when they finally get the magazine back and they bring them a cake to celebrate, they end up seeing the front of the magazine and the police are really, really upset about it. Now, the thing is, it's funny. It's a really funny joke of the idea of like these idiots who are anti-police and then the police being really nice to them. But then weirdly you're watching it and it's like, but is the show kind of being pro-police? Is by making so much fun of the people who are anti-police, are they kind of shearing up? Is the show basically saying, hey kids, give the police some respect? It's a weird show. In those terms, I think there are moments for me where it almost feels like the writers are saying, stop being silly. Like, ladies, stop being silly. Growing hair in your armpits, that's silly. You might as well grow a beard. And I think because of that, because of this slightly almost old man prejudice that informs some of the jokes and some of the plot lines, I don't think it does what it thinks it's doing. And so to answer your question in that very long way, I don't think it quite achieves what it's setting out to do. I don't think it lampoons the 60s in a particularly nice, effective or original way.
I think you're right, really. Is it that post sort of, you know, Cool Britannia kind of thing? You know, this is late 90s. The Cool Britannia things come off the back of like New Labour, you know, coming in, and you've got the Spice Girls, you know, going back and, you know, and in terms of, you know, recapturing the sort of 60s vibe, you've got things like their Spice World movie, which has loads of like 60s actors in it and all this. And you've got Austin Powers, you know, at the same time coming out, and all this kind of 60s spoofery that's happening in a lot of different TV shows, movies at the time. And, you know, it feels like they're looking back at it with a slight level of smugness. In a way. I mean, and they, you know, they do, like, I mean, they literally do a graduate gag, don't they, at one point, where, and it's quite well executed, but you've got when Eleanor LeBron's mother of Alex, he's trying to seduce Ray, you have the shot of her leg and her, you know, and her tights as he walks in, but it's not actually her. You know, it's like a sculpture thing. And it is quite a funny joke. But I think the show works better when it's doing that kind of absurdity as opposed to actually trying to riff on the 60s. Like, it does have some moments that are lean a bit more into the kind of black book stuff that Linehan would do. There's one where, and some of them are quite clever jokes. Like there's Alex in the last episode being chased by a bunch of workmen, but it plays on the idea that in TV shows, when people are getting chased, they almost reach the person and then it'll cut to a different shot where they're not there. And all Alex is doing is walking and these men are running, these workmen, you'll get the hippie, but they never reach him. And each cut, it's very well done. It's a very funny joke and it's very well done. So it has, and then there's other stuff like Ray falling down endless staircases when he's pushed down the stairs and it plays again and again and again. And to the point that it's almost too many. It's just, but they're very, it's a very good bit of surrealism. And I actually think the show should have done more of that and less maybe of the poking fun at the 60s. I think it works in a way better when it's veering into that hyper reality of this is a bit weird. I wanted it to be weirder, really, I think.
Yeah, I'd go with that. Because I think when it pokes fun, it's not as affectionate as something like Austin Powers. You know, Austin Powers, no. I think, gets the balance right of being, you know, sort of like affectionate and loving, but kind of saying it was all a bit silly, wasn't it? Whereas when this pokes fun, it feels a bit snidey.
Yeah.
There are some jokes in this where you feel like, oh, I wouldn't want to have a drunk conversation with the man who wrote this joke about this topic. You get that vibe from it. But some of the surreal gags are brilliant. And funnily enough, but you know what? This is the other thing, is that I think that sometimes they have jokes that they should have pushed further. So the falling down the stairs, I would have put two more in there.
I would have really
cranked it up. Although that's another, I mean, this is a whole other conversation that we can get on to another time. I actually think that Linehan and Matthews, I think I've said this before in other episodes, they are a little bit pinchy in some of their gags. I think they can be collectors, let's say, to be kind. And that joke, I have seen it somewhere else before, and I can't remember where. It may have been an airplane type movie. It could have been
Men
Don't Wear Plaid or something. I can't remember, but I've definitely seen that joke done somewhere else before. I can't remember where it is. And that I did, watching this show again now, more recently, there were moments where I was like, oh, you took that joke from this. Oh, you stole that from there, didn't you? Oh, you borrowed this from here. Some, you know, films and TV shows that maybe I hadn't watched or wasn't aware of when I saw this first time round, I now came back to it and I was like, damn, you do like to borrow. Let's say borrow. Let's be nice. They borrow things.
Yeah, they do. They do, to be fair. I mean, a good joke is a good joke, admittedly, but I think if you go back and you see the original, usually they're better. You know, we made that point recently with Porridge, didn't we, about the beaker, you know, from here.
From here.
Yeah, which is a good joke, but it was done better the first time round. I just feel like hippies, I mean, interestingly, there was general consensus that the first episode they put out, which was, I think it was about this kind of American super hippie guy. Was the weakest of all of them, and there was confusion.
Worst one.
Yeah, and there was confusion. Why did you put that out? And originally, the pilot episode was supposed to be the fourth episode called Hippie Dippy Hippies, which was then reshot. They reshot the pilot, and then it became the fourth episode. So nobody knows what was in that pilot episode, and it's whether or not maybe originally there was more surrealism. Maybe originally it was going to be a bit more Father Ted-like in that sense, you know, and maybe they dialed that back and went in a different direction. And whether or not that works, I don't know, you know.
I think the order, the broadcast order, the watching order, it suffers a lot from, because it really feels like you're watching the middle three episodes. And then you watch the start of it. And the weirdest thing is the fourth episode, it opens up with a little, you know, basically a cold open, which is like a TV article saying, oh, hippies, where they come from? These young people are putting together a magazine. And it introduces the characters. It tells you their names.
Yeah.
Up until this point, nobody's told you what they're called other than them referring to each other's first names. And the weird thing is that that little cold open, it doesn't really affect the rest of the episode. The rest of the episode does have them, you know, going into making a magazine and all this kind of stuff. But you could have just taken that cold open and put it at the beginning of the very first episode. And the whole series would have made a bit more sense. But they didn't. And it's really weird. And especially the this professor character that they have. He isn't introduced until, I think it's the third, maybe it is the fourth episode. But he gets introduced halfway through, but is a big part of their lives. And you suddenly find out that Jill is at university and she's studying under this pervy professor and all this kind of thing. Yeah. It's like, we needed to know that a while ago, because we now know that Jill is only, you know, maybe 19 or 20. She's not a young woman who, you know, I know how these things work. I work in television. Sometimes you shoot your six episodes and somebody somewhere at the top says, nah, this one's a better first episode. And you put them out of order. It happens a lot. I don't know why it was done with this, because I think it was the weakest episode that they put out first. Maybe the most anarchic, maybe the most kind of like young onesy vibe, but it's a terrible episode to set things up. It doesn't set it up well. It treats the characters as established. It's like, so as an audience, you're kind of like, I think you're expected to know them a little bit too well. Because also it's the fact that, you know, Jill sort of starts having a sort of affair with this other guy that comes in. You don't care. It's the first time you've met her. She's just a woman in this who works there. And this guy Ray is a little bit pervy over, a bit horny for her. But then episodes later, you discover that she is actually his girlfriend and they've got an open relationship. And it's like, well, we didn't know any of this before. And I think it just shows the importance of putting your episodes out in the right order, to be honest.
Yeah, and I wonder why that happened. It's a strange one, because maybe they thought that they wanted it to be a bit more conventional, in the sense that, you know, that for a lot of the... I mean, it's not an expensive show. They didn't really have any exteriors, particularly. A lot of it is interior. A lot of it is set around the flat. You know, it's full of all this, you know, these posters, this hippie sort of counterculture stuff. So they didn't have a lot of money, and maybe they just wanted to do a bit more of a conventional... I mean, in that first episode, there's like a big John Lennon, Yoko Ono gag, isn't there? You know, where they recreate the bed, you know, their bed protest and things like this. So maybe they thought that these were easier 60s ideas for people to latch onto than some of the other... Maybe they were worried that...
Yeah, like a more instantly identifiable.
Yeah, maybe they were worried that they would have... that if they'd have started with an episode about a magazine and a youth magazine, that it would have been that people might not have clicked with it. But then conversely, I think, like you say, they didn't really introduce the show in a way that made complete sense. And had they done that, more people might, and all with a particularly funny episode. You know, there are funnier episodes after this, and you think, well, who made that decision and why? I think it was probably motivated on and nervousness about the material and about what they were doing, potentially, which I think is always dangerous when you're going into something. You know, you've got to go in bold as you can, really. And so, yeah, it's strange. It is strange because they don't lead with their strongest material at all with this.
Yeah, it could be exactly that they wanted to put something more identifiable. Because I guess the idea of underground magazines, you know, people know about it, but I suppose it's not as, for a lot of people, it's not as synonymous as, you know, John Lennon sitting in a bed, boom, yeah, that's hippies, that's the 60s. People making fan magazines on, you know, cheap printing equipment in their flat, that for a lot of people, that doesn't necessarily scream 60s, even though it is a, you know, it's a really good, this show has all the ingredients.
Yeah, no,
doesn't
it?
That was a good choice. This could have been set at a you know, it could have been, you know, music producers in the 60s. It could have been set at a big magazine in the 60s. But this is a really good setting, the kind of, you know, little grungy underground magazine made by idiots, because there were a lot of those in the 60s. Every fucker made a magazine in the 60s, and half of them aren't remembered.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe it did, you know, maybe they were worried that wouldn't click with audiences.
But it's classic. That's the thing, though. It's classic British comedy setting, in that you take a bunch of hopeless, you know, losers, really. You put them in a small contained environment where they're, you know, it is in the tradition of so many good British sitcoms, where you have these characters, they're just useless, but it doesn't, it's like it's afraid of its core idea in a way. It's like it doesn't lean into that enough. It doesn't go for it. And even if it's not super identifiable, it doesn't sort of go for broke and really... I think that hesitancy causes issues, really. And the fact that it's cobbled together from various different better sitcoms that have done a lot of these ideas before, certainly a lot of these essential jokes, you know, essential core character sort of jokes and things. It's done them before, and it's been sharper doing that. So I think it's a bit of a shame, because I think a lot of the ideas and a lot of the setting is fertile ground that hadn't really been explored in this way before. But the approach just isn't quite there, sadly.
Yeah, it just doesn't quite nail it.
No, it doesn't really. But yeah, I mean, before we go on this one, what would you say if anyone was going to go and watch this? And to be fair, it's very seldom repeated. I think it got one DVD release quite a while ago, but it might be quite difficult to track down. They are all on YouTube, though, to be fair. You can watch all of them on YouTube, which is honestly where I watched them. So they are available. Then it's not a very good copy, obviously. You know, it's quite it's not the sharpest you'll see the show or anything. But yeah, but they're all there. So what episode would you recommend if people went to go and check this out? Which one would you go for?
I don't know, because I don't think, yeah, I mean, I like I say, I quite like it. I've got a soft spot for it, but I don't think there's any one episode which really blows it out of the water. I'd probably say episode 4, Hippie Dippy
right,
Hippies.
Yeah.
Only because that basically should have been episode 1. I think you could watch episode 4 and then, if you like it, skip back to what is actually episode 1 and then watch them through from there. I think Sexy Hippies might be the funniest.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's the first one that gets very... that gets very funny. Maybe. Yeah, and I've just forgotten which episode is it that has Peter Serafinowicz.
Oh, yeah, I think that's Hairy Hippies, because that's the one where Ray's doing like a play.
Of course it's Hairy Hippies, yes, it's the second episode.
And he did say he would, Martha Matthews did say he would bring, he plays a character called Robin, who is really, really, he's really awful. He's a really intense, nasty guy.
He's that brilliant.
And he's saying, I will break.
That brilliant Serafinowicz.
He's like, if you tell me what to do again, I will break your prick off. It's that kind of really.
Yeah, are you listening to me? Are you listening to me? I will break your... Are you listening? He's amazing at it. Yeah, so that's that episode as a whole is not as funny. I think Sexy Hippies is probably funnier overall.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Probably because they're getting into that kind of like, sexy, which plays on obviously all those 60s tropes. But I think that, yeah, the second episode, Hairy Hippies, is just really good fun simply for Peter Serafinowicz.
Yeah, he's great.
Mm-hmm. So I would, yeah, I'd say definitely watch the Hippie Dippy Hippies, whatever it is. Watch episode 4 first, because that'll just get you in the right spot. Then maybe watch episode 2, because Peter Serafinowicz will sell it to you. Then watch episode 3, and then go and watch the others however you like. So
I guess I'd agree with that, actually. Yeah, I think Sexy Hippies is probably the funnier one, but I agree. And it's one of those things where there are various different good jokes or decent characters in episodes, and there isn't necessarily enough to recommend the whole episode. But yeah, I think that's a fair...
Yes, I think that's it, isn't it?
I think that's a fair roadmap, really. I think it's pretty good to do that, because, you know, it is a shame that he didn't actually go for it and try and do more and improve this, because he was going to do some funny stuff. He said that Alex was going to enter a competition for Britain's most laid-back person. Ray was convinced he was going to be featured on This Is Your Life. This would have been a dark one. Jill joins a suicide cult. So, you know, there are some ideas, I think, that could have been quite funny and quite subversive. You know, and this is the thing, like, Arthur Matthews is working with people like, you know, Chris Morris at the time, who's doing stuff like Brass Eye and doing Jam, you know, and he's making, they're making Big Train, which was probably one of the strangest sketch shows ever made. And really, one I'd love to go back and watch again, because I think, you know, Big Train was hugely, like, put out there at the time. It was really cult, but everyone was talking about Big Train around this time. So, you know, Arthur Matthews is involved in some really sort of avant-garde comedy. And I wish, and I mean, you can't get darker than some of Chris Morris's stuff, really. So it would have been great to, it would have been great to see some of that creep in, as well as some of that absurdism, really, and just go for it with an episode like Jill Joined the Suicide Cult. Just go for that kind of thing. So it's a real shame, because I think they could have built on a lot of these comic ideas, and you know, and it might well have found its feet potentially in a second season, like we said earlier.
Yeah, I think that's the whole thing, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's a show that had potential and wasn't given the chance to fulfill that potential. Something like Paris wasn't good enough. It, you know, the pieces were not good enough, you know, like to get anything more out of that. But this had all the right pieces. It had all the, you know, we've just sort of said that, you know, these first six episodes that they did, it's like most episodes had a couple of good jokes, a couple of good, you know, guest performances, but there's not one episode that really stands out and kind of says, ah, yeah, this is the one. And I think a second series might have rectified that, might have focused down a little bit.
Yeah, it might have done. Yeah. Final question then. Does Hippies stand the test of time? Will it stand the test of time? Will it have a bit of an afterlife? Will people come and find it? And will they see, you know, comedy in it about the 60s, you know, as we get further away from the 60s and the 90s, in fact, you know? And or is it destined to remain in relative obscurity, do you think, Rob?
I think you know the answer to this one.
Yeah. I think I do.
I mean, everything we've just said about it, I think it's one of those that I think people will keep finding it. And I think people will keep kind of like noticing it, probably because of the Simon Pegg thing.
Yeah.
I think that Simon Pegg in particular is going to keep getting new fans. And I think when somebody says, oh, I really like Simon Pegg, I like this new film, there's always going to be someone who'll say, oh, have you watched Spaced? Mm. And if somebody gets into Spaced, there's going to be someone who says, oh, have you tried Hippies?
Yeah.
It's nowhere near as good as Spaced, but he's great in it. So I think it's one of those ones simply because of the people in it, and mostly that's Pegg. I think that people are always going to sort of come back to it, but I don't think it's going to be anyone's... You know, this isn't anyone's first recommendation.
No.
If you're telling someone to go and watch stuff that these other performers have done. And yeah, I don't think it. I mean, I've already said it at length. You know, I think that other things riffed on the 60s better earlier and since. I don't think it does any of the things it's trying to do particularly well. So I don't think it stands the test of time. I think as much as I quite like it and have a soft spot, it's not hilariously funny, and I think around the edges every one of these we do we talk about how, you know, oh well, you know, sitcoms from the 70s, you know, people don't, you know, the different times, different ideals and stuff. Of course this feels contemporary, but it's not. It's 20 odd years ago. Whether intentionally or not, whether the writers were aware of it, which they probably weren't, there is some misogyny to it, and you know, it skirts with homophobia and transphobia in a way that I think is unintentional, but I think it's the middle-aged old man way that it pokes fun at hippies and hippie culture can't help but take in some of the groundwork of what has now actually become sort of like contemporary acceptable culture. So I think a young audience watching this, they're not going to be, you know, as offended as they might be with some shows from the 70s. It's probably less offensive than something like Absolutely Fabulous could be, to be honest. But I think some people would come away with an unpleasant taste in their mouth from watching it.
Yeah.
So well, no.
No, yeah. No,
it doesn't stand the test
of time. I agree. I think something like Ab Fab has aged better, you know, than this. This oddly...
It's aged. It's aged.
This oddly is quite old. It's quite dated now. I mean, how scary is it though that the 90s has now become that decade for us, where we're going, oh, some of it's not.
Know.
You know, Jesus Christ, this was the stuff we grew up with when we were teenagers. You know, and when we were going into adulthood, and this is now the stuff that, you know, back in the 90s or the noughties, we'd look back at the 70s and go, oh, that's a bit dodgy, isn't it? But now it's the 90s that's happening to, you know? And even like, so that's a bit of a sobering thought to end on. But no, I think you're right. I don't think it will. It is more of a deep dive kind of thing. There are some decent ideas. There's a lot of talent. You know, it's one, if, yeah, like you say, if people are interested in certain of these other things these actors have done, and particularly, you know, these, I'd say, yeah, check, watch Hippies, see what you think, you know. And there have been some interesting defences of it in recent years and some of the research I've done, which are quite compelling, but they don't make me change my mind. And I don't think the cultural impact will really ever be there, to be fair. And it's very difficult for that ever to happen with a six-part show, with one season, unless it turns out to be an absolute dynamite series of television that only got one series, but everyone just goes, that was an amazing series and it should have had more. Hippies isn't one of them. So yeah, I think it will be an interesting footnote in a lot of the careers of these people, particularly Simon Pegg, who's now off, you know, going into space and jumping from a, you know, whatever with Tom Cruise. God knows what he's going to do with it.
Yeah, I bet Tom Cruise has got this on DVD. I bet he sits there. He's like, what am I going to watch tonight, guys? Let's put on Hippies.
Let's watch some Hippies.
Love those Hippies, man. So radical. Hey, he's so cool.
Do you know what?
But they don't overstep the line.
It wouldn't surprise me, right? Anything's possible with that man, I think. But yeah, so it's been fun to talk about, though. It's fun to watch. It's been fun to do a bit of research on. So yeah. Cheers, Rob. It's been a good one. And so until we're back talking, I think our next one's going to be Whoops Apocalypse that we're going to be coming in a couple of weeks. That'll be interesting. Another cult short-lived show. So until then, where can people find what you're up to?
As always, the best place is on Twitter. I am Forducks, which is Forducks. Whatever I'm doing, I promote it there. I also rant about other things if you want to hear my opinions.
I agree so often, you know, with the... Yeah, so it's like, yeah, it's worth it. It's worth it, folks.
Yeah, so you come for the podcast, stay for the tweets. But I'm popping up here and there. I'm going to be... I've been doing some podcasting with Podcast 616, talking Hulk recently, so you can check those ones out. And I'll be cropping up on there again, hopefully in the future, as well as I'm always cropping up on Real Talk as well when there's something in my wheelhouse. So stick me into the We Made This search bar and I'm sure you'll find me somewhere.
Marvellous. Similar for me, really. You'll find me at AJ Black Writer on Twitter, mainly. My website, www.culturalconversation.co.uk. My personal website with all my links to books and podcasts and writing and things. And also, generally on We Made This, which is at @we_made_this on Twitter. We Made This on Facebook and our website, wemadethisnetwork.com for all the other podcasts, things Rob has mentioned, various others I'm on as well. So check us out there. But yeah, thank you guys for joining us for this chat and about Hippies. And please subscribe to You Have Been Watching. Give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, as I said at the top. And if you want to help out the network, We Made This more broadly, please consider supporting us on Patreon. If you get to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. Hippies, however, is not all we're talking about, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in just a moment. But until next time, you've been listening to Tony Black
and Robert Turnbull,
and we're off to build a love state in Notting Hill Gates.
Yeah, man, like, it's so far out, it's amazing.
Hey guys, my name is Tony Black, podcaster and author, and I'm here to tell you about Partisan, a podcast about politics and history in film and entertainment. I'll be joined by guests as we discuss films, TV shows, and maybe a little bit more, examining political and historical topics, such as how Elvis intersects with black cultural history.
In Lerman's film, the idea of the black characters are maybe kind of, they're used as catalysts to basically move Elvis forward in his career. I think that's how I saw it.
The rise and fall of Richard Nixon.
It seems to be historians seem to agree with this, is that he was the first president that really capitalized on the evangelical vote and politicized them.
The disturbing class satire in society and much, much more. Partisan is free to download on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Partisan Pod. I hope you'll vote with your feet and join us on the journey.